Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, today is a very special day.
Yeah, and it's not because this time Bob's on the phone, not because he got stuck in traffic or he misscheduled us. Tell us why you were experiencing This Life more vividly. But before you do, I want to introduce Caleb Bacon. Caleb.
Hey,
and,
Bob.
And when we let Bob go to life, Caleb will take over. And then Bob Newton. And Bob, introduce yourself.
Hi.
Go right into this thing.
Oh.
There you go.
Hi, Bob. Bob Newton here.
And,
howdy. Howdy.
And Bob, you worked with Betty Ford for a long time, right?
I'm still with them.
With them.
For the last 15 years.
And mostly working with youth and relapse prevention?
A variety of...
Variety of functions. We'll find out all about that.
The day treatment too, right?
Yes. Yes.
And Caleb, you want to give a little sketch about yourself real quick?
Sure. I'm a comedy writer, a friend of some people in this room, and also...
Podcast?
A podcaster and fan of recovery.
And give the name of your podcast.
The podcast that I've done for a long time. I don't know how long. It's called Man School. It's currently on hiatus.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, which is not that exciting to plug. But
no. Bob, I was on his podcast. We were working out together, and I was just telling him I went down to Florida to give a talk, and I was working out that afternoon in a gym, and a guy walks up to me, pulls out his headphones, he goes, "I'm listening to you and Caleb work out right now." So that's the reach of podcast. So tell us, what is this life happening? What part of this life is happening to you right now?
Well, I'm sitting here in the hospital with Chrissy, my gal, and we're waiting on our daughter, and here's her heartbeat. Can you hear that?
Yes, she's got a little...
156. Is that good, Drew?
That's good. So she has... It's the decelerations you have to worry about. When it slows down during contractions in too much.
Yeah, it goes up and down, I know. And then Chrissy's blood pressure's come way down. It's 125 over 80, and we've just been sitting here for 30 hours.
Is she in labor?
Yeah, she has been. It's like the cervix wasn't done, you know, it wasn't dilated enough, and then they put this balloon in. Modern medicine's crazy, Drew. I don't know how you guys do it.
And then, Bob, you had another sort of interesting thing happen in your life since our last podcast, right?
Well, yeah, my mom's funeral was yesterday, so this has been a crazy week of forest magic.
Your sister mom.
Yeah, sister mom. You know, she's the one that did this with me.
She had you.
Yeah, she had me.
So how you doing? Are you okay?
Yeah, it's been not a lot of time to think, that's for sure. Because, you know, it's just one life in, one life out.
Wow.
It's crazy. It's been a crazy week. I'm not even realizing what it means. I just keep doing what I'm supposed to do.
How was it with your family? And was it Oklahoma?
I couldn't go because we were on bed rest, like... You know, with this blood pressure stuff.
Oh, my God. So she was in the hospital with a blood pressure crisis. Your mom's funeral. Is your sister doing okay? It's your actual sister, right?
Yeah, my sister is doing all right. Okay. It was weird, though. I was, you know, they wanted me to talk to my mom before she died because it was done the, whatever it's called, where you're pulling the plug. And so my sister put the phone up next to her head, and I just kept saying familiar words, and everybody's telling me she's brain dead, Drew.
Yeah.
And I keep saying Elvis, which is my son, and it's Bobby, and all the familiar words. You remember living in the desert? Remember when we used to, I kept just saying, you know, words that would make her feel familiar for like 15 minutes, and all of a sudden she said what I always say when I greet anybody or see anybody is, "Hey, hey," and so I answer my phone all the time, "Hey, hey, it's Bob," and she would always say, "Hey, hey, it's Nancy," and so she said, "Hey, hey, Drew, explain that if she's brain dead."
No, she's not brain dead. She's not. She's just unable to have meaningful function, right? You can sometimes have various little glimmers. It's like Swiss cheese. Little areas can function. There can be little areas where they have sometimes reflexive, sometimes meaningful or purposeful action, But that doesn't mean they can breathe on their own. That doesn't mean they can eat on their own.
Yeah, she couldn't breathe on her own or eat on, swallow. She couldn't swallow.
Right. And so it's not a life worth living. Right?
I know. We need to have real adult conversation about this, but since we can't have adult conversations about anything, I doubt we will.
Well, there's lots of people. Listen, California has moved forward on the death and dying front. Now you can do that. You can choose to die on your own terms. If you have a terminal illness and less than 6 months to live, there's ways to go about that now.
I know we had a shocking thing at that Stanley Cup party a couple months ago. An acquaintance of mine walked up and said, you know, we were visiting and whatever, and then he's been sick a long time, and he said, so this is probably the last time I'll see you. And I was like, what? And he goes, yeah, I'm terminal. It's throughout my body, and I'm waiting. And he said he was waiting for the date when it's legal. It was coming up this, I think, September.
Yeah, yeah, the summer.
And isn't that's crazy to be at a luncheon with a guy who's saying, this is probably the last time I'm going to see you because I'm going to end my suffering. How crazy is that?
Well, maybe we here in the studio will continue to talk about these more depressing topics. But, Bob, you're in the middle of something glorious. So.
Well, but it's about life.
Yes,
life
it is.
Listen, life is coming right now.
Listen, and a life well lived includes a certain kind of death, too. Maybe we'll talk about that here, you know, amongst ourselves.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Should I let Bob go? Is that Bob, do you want to go back to your duties there?
Yeah, I'm back to my duties. To getting ready. We're getting ready next hour.
All right.
Having the next hour.
All right, buddy. Good luck.
All right.
Let
you
us
guys
know.
Have
Texas,
a great afternoon.
Texas when it's all over, okay?
Kiss the baby for me.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye, buddy.
Bye-bye.
All right, so I just thought we'd touch in with him because he couldn't be here today. Sure. He was looking forward to seeing you and meeting you. And to tell people a little bit about your career and how you got involved with it and your recovery and whatnot.
Well, I'm originally from Southern California, and then I went to the school at University of Nebraska and played football for Nebraska University on their 1970 national championship team. Went into the NFL for 11 years, five years with the Chicago Bears and 6 years with the Seattle Seahawks. Within a year after my termination from the Seahawks, I entered treatment for chemical dependency in Monroe, Washington, at a small hospital-based facility called Valley General Hospital.
Can I just say, not to gloss over the football stuff, because that's really impressive.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's,
no, I'm a huge, huge football fan.
And by the way, that was back in the days. Yeah. You're too young for this, but that was when I was watching football, like really watching it.
Sure, leather helmets and everything.
No, not quite that bad.
I kid.
More about the fearsome foursome and Walter Payton and all this stuff.
Sure.
And
no, my grandfather.
Jack Ham and the nickel defense was invented. And,
right.
You know, a guy like Jim Kick could be a running back.
That's right.
You know?
That was, and guys like Dick Butkus roaming the field.
Yeah.
They probably
wouldn't
let Dick play now.
Yeah.
He was too violent. So.
Jim Brown might have had some issues today.
Yeah.
Today?
My gym was phenomenal.
If he was to play
today.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
But so it was a career that I'm still very proud of. And
if I'm going to stop you, too. By the way, the Rams are back in Los Angeles. That's when you were playing.
What was the final score last night?
They won 28-27, 24.
I had to go somewhere, and I turned it off. Dallas was still leading.
They have a tight end right now. He's number 86. I forget his name. But it will be on all of our tongues soon. The guy was... Like the new Gronkowski. Like we got one.
He's a big guy.
Yeah. Well, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
Shearing
or
something? Or Shear?
The real score from last night was 90,000.
Oh,
there were 90,000 people.
For exhibition.
Biggest in the history of the NFL domestically, I think, other than when they went to like Mexico City.
But not only that, I looked at that in terms of a success, and then I thought, what a headache for SC. I mean, they got to turn that around every day. Do a college game with 90,000, and then do it. They should have done it in the Rose Bowl. It would have been fine.
Yeah,
but then they have the same problem with UCLA here. So anyway, I'm sorry. So you're 11 years in the NFL, and you get treatment in Monroe.
Yeah, and you know, I admitted that I had a very progressive illness of alcoholism.
I was going to say the usual thing for an NFL player these days is painkillers.
Yeah.
Back then it was more alcohol, social.
Well, my drugs of choice was alcohol, marijuana and cocaine.
Which, if you don't mind me interrupting you.
No, not at all.
Just kind of editorializing for listeners and stuff, which is that's a typical combo. That's a, you know, when people come into treatment, that's a very common combination.
Yeah.
Which of those did you have most difficulty giving up?
Well, I think alcohol was always a severe problem. Yeah. And I got introduced to cocaine in the early 70s, and it was introduced to me as a recreational drug. Yes. And I said, well, I like recreation.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's how... Yeah. 3 years later, I'm buying it once a week.
And non-addictive recreational drug.
Non-addictive.
It's non-habit-forming.
Non-habit-forming.
Yeah, I think that's what the package is.
There was so much BS about that. But what people are surprised, if you're not smoking crack, if you're snorting cocaine, doing pot, and doing alcohol, the cocaine is not as hard as the pot and the alcohol usually.
Yeah. That's my biggest concern for our society now is with marijuana. And I know for me it was a very highly addictive psychological drug, and I've seen that in a lot of other folks that we've treated. Yeah. But alcohol was always, and I came from a significant family of alcoholism.
Of course.
And so, you know, age 15, 16, I started, but it was just periodic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I never drank in the morning, and so I couldn't really identify. My typical perception was the Skid Row wino.
Right.
So, I had legal problems. I started getting DUIs, and that kind of forced me to really look at it, and I'm grateful for that today.
Now, Bob, I'm sober 8.5 years myself, and not to glamorize any of your drug use, but the cocaine must have been fantastic back then.
Well,
like I didn't even have the opportunity to use that kind of cocaine.
Yeah.
Is that right? It's cut differently now?
Well, it's one of those things where you hear some people say, you know, back in my day, this stuff used to really work.
Huh.
Not full of all this baby laxative.
Used to really work. Well, now they put speed in there, and that's the problem.
Yeah.
We see a lot of weird reactions.
But, the potency of it, it got me high. It got me loaded. And I like to use it when I was drinking because I'd get a little intoxicated, and I could do that. And then I'd sober up a little bit and then drink some more. But it was... Like I said, it was introduced as a recreational drug, and then years later we see, you know, how it did start affecting with crack and with freebasing was the thing. If you're not freebasing, you don't have a problem with it back then, you know, because Richard Pryor, he was one of the first ones to
pioneer,
to popularize in the public mind, as it were.
Yeah.
I'm thinking right now, Bob's still on my mind. Bob Forrest still on my mind a little bit in that. You worked a lot with young people. You have worked. Are you still working with young people now?
I work with young people and
because right now
with
that,
athletes
that's been a major preoccupation of Bob Forrest. He works over at that Aloe House. Do you work with him over there at all?
No, I haven't.
Well, they're very proud of themselves for being non-judgmental and being open-minded, and you know they're even, it sounds like, you know, willing to kind of sort of meet people on their own terms in terms of when abstinence is achieved. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a new idea. And I've noticed it more and more in the literature, which is, well, if you're looking for abstinence, here's the best way to do that. But they've started sort of backing off now with all the replacement therapies and stuff. I'm not a fan. My treatment was always about abstinence and returning to a fully flourishing life,
absolutely,
not being chronically ill. But these days, you kind of have to meet people where they are. It's crazy.
Well, I know that... that's my I still believe in from the original philosophy that it's an illness, and that if I take the first drink or first drug, it's going to agitate my compulsion, and I'm going to be off and running fairly quickly.
That's factually true.
Yeah, but there are a lot of medications assistance now, and I'm all for. I know what 25, 30 years ago AA or 12-step programs were against. Antidepressant medications, and I've seen some value of that, and I hope there's value in the assisted medication process we're going through.
I hope so. It's very concerning. I've seen a lot of disasters, but I've seen some good things. Just they're not carefully selecting for whom these things should be used. Just sort of everybody gets it, and I wouldn't want, you know, any of us in here to get it where we develop addiction. We would just be take long-term treatment, do abstinence.
Yeah.
And the commitment to treatment has also been diminished. People need to spend a lot of time in treatment. There's some data out just recently that shows that on average for alcoholism, it takes 4 to 5 treatments to get 1 year of sobriety. And I think largely that's because people are pushed in and out of treatment. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you could stay in treatment 2 years, you would sustain. You'd keep going. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you but you never get that first 6 months. And go ahead. Well,
that's a great example. I've worked with patients in the past that wanted out of treatment in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month or,
yeah.
And they've been using 10, 12, 15 years. And I would say, you know, we can do so much in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but look what we're going against. You got a 20-year history of a significant addiction.
Yeah.
And it's
just
tough.
Just your brain, just letting your brain recover exactly. For 6 months to a year.
Well, Bob, so when you were training for the NFL, it took more than 2 weeks to get ready for that?
You know, the sad thing, and I know I'm so happy for Michael Phillips in the – phenomenal.
Yeah, not much is being made of that. Is it Michael Phelps you're talking about?
I mean, Michael Phelps, excuse me. Yeah.
But not much is being made of his recovery, which I...
Yeah.
That is a double-edged sword. I look at that and I go, oh, that's a dude that's very much into his recovery. He's not grandstanding. He's just in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's usually a very humble process, and it seems like that's why he's not talking about it.
Yeah.
But it's an opportunity missed to really talk about, you know, or he should put somebody up in front of him to say, hey, you know, he's permitted me to say one of the big pieces of my success is every day I work a part of my recovery. You know?
And maybe hopefully that'll – but it is publicized that he went to treatment for 45 days and that he's sober and clean. And I just think it's phenomenal. I hope a lot of other – athletes. That's what I regret the most about my NFL career. I don't think I ever reached my potential because of my chemical use. And each year it got harder and harder physically and mentally to get prepared because of the insidious progression of my chemical dependency. So, and then by the time I was age 32, you know, I still had the passion to play, but physically and mentally that off season I hadn't put in the time and the work, and it caught up with me.
Did you coach or anything after that? Or
I've coached high school, and I was a graduate assistant coach at Nebraska, and I've coached a little junior college. And I like working with young people. I like planting seeds, and there's so many mixed messages young people receive now, I think, with chemical use. And but you hit a hot button there with the opiate use, because they used to give us codeine, what else, mostly codeine when we had pain issues on the plane coming back from
back when it was good.
Well, that's all they had was codeine. It's really the only oral one they had, really.
And now this opiate epidemic that's really concerning. I've seen a lot of people come back into treatment getting tripped unintentionally back into their addiction
all the time,
or dead
at the hands of my peers. That combo of benzo opiate, there it is. That's what kills people.
Bob, what were some of the ways that your disease affected your performance as a player? Like, did you have trouble memorizing the playbook because of pot?
Well at times. I think the most I was my behavior was unpredictable. And my play was inconsistent. So one game I'd have a phenomenal game, and they would think the next, maybe that week, because of the hangovers or whatever, I didn't put in the time in the weight room or run the sprints, and I go into a game overconfident, and I get my butt kicked. And so it was the inconsistency, I think, affected me, and on the practice field and in game time. And, you know, coachable. Some days I was very coachable. Sometimes if I went in there hungover, I was irritable, discontented. And then just the anxiety that some hangovers and my drunken behavior caused the night before, that would linger with me for 2 or 3 days, you know. And I know it was affecting my preparation. So
let's talk about young people you are encountering. What do you see to be the thing today? What's happening to young people? What is there something we can characterize?
Well, I think they're getting into the opiates just
Early.
Yeah, way early, and we see the ODs that are taking place.
Is there something spiritually going on with young people that we're not addressing, or we're not seeing, or we don't experience because we're not their age?
That's a good point, Drew. I don't know. They have the hole in the souls like we all have, and if they're trying to use chemicals to fill it up, like older people do or have.
Bob Forrest has been describing, and I've encountered this too, that he's having difficulty getting them to want to have meaning in life.
Because they, yeah. What do you want to do? What do you want to be? How do you want to flourish? Yeah. And they're like, I don't know. What do you want me to do? Which is the scariest comment of all. Do you see this too, Caleb?
Well, kind of what comes to mind when you bring this up is just the access to opiates. Like, when I grew up, they weren't in the medicine cabinet.
Yeah.
But it seems like, you know, someone's mom had a wrist surgery. Now there's just a big bottle of something that could be fun. And so that changes the situation.
Yeah, I'd like to know what this... You may know, Drew, the stats of use back for... when young people start using it 12, 13, 14 years of age, I mean, their development and maturity is so impaired. And especially if they continue using...
Yeah, absolutely. They miss those developmental milestones. They just don't develop.
Yeah.
And certain drugs like cannabis actually changes the brain structure, and so we worry about that. It seems to stay permanent. We don't really know what it all means yet.
Yeah.
It means you become a comedy writer.
Is that when you started?
About 13.
With pot?
Yeah.
That's your typical stuff, pot and alcohol.
But I was 6 foot tall, so like it seemed okay.
Yeah.
Pretty grown guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had tolerance.
A little bit. Tolerance for cheap beer. And.
Sure. Well, I remember the day I was in treatment. I was so grateful I hadn't killed somebody driving my car intoxicated. I've never forgot that day, and I hope I never will, because that could have happened. Even when I was 16, that could have happened so many times. And I know my reactions were impaired. I was under the influence, and I really have a lot of gratitude around that. That didn't happen. How do you? I'm sure you have, Drew, been with people that. But if you take a life and you're under the influence, how do you live with that? I might get sober, you go through treatment, but you still got that between your ears.
The ones that I have seen, I haven't seen a lot of that. I've treated a lot of that, but the ones I have don't get sober. Yeah. They keep going back. They keep having real trouble living with it, you know, and oftentimes the families are pushing litigation and upset and not forgiving in any way. And
it's a tough one.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, it's the ultimately they have to go take the medicine of whatever it is, the consequence of what they've done is, and that's a tall order too.
Sure.
Now I don't know. I don't see them on the other side of prison. I don't know if they maybe find something there.
Yeah.
Often people do.
Yeah.
But I can only hope.
Yeah,
because otherwise it's a fatal thing.
Yeah,
it's tough.
I agree.
So, what are your concerns today? What else are you pushing? What else are you interested in? What else do you want people to know about?
I just like to, when I go out and speak with people, no matter what the age, I just like to build awareness about the disease of addiction and the signs and symptoms and where you can get help. And
how about getting help? These days we're sort of upset, you know, Bob Forrest and I, that a lot of the places are just businesses and they mill people through, and there isn't a dedicated staff necessarily, or you know, it changes over time and there's no standards and there's so many things to be worried about.
Yeah.
I really get sort of apoplectic sometimes about the treatment field now. I'm a little outside of it, and it's because it got too hard. It's too, I don't know.
Well, I think there's a lot of concern nationally about that, about where the true the true meaning is of treatment centers. Is it just to make a financial return, or to really help the patients that are coming in there? I know I still work with a lot of folks that I've been related to with the Hazel and Betty Ford Center now, and I've always admired Hazelden for starting. You know,
they maintain a high level of quality. If you got the Hazelden moniker attached to a program, you can be pretty reliably assured that you're getting a good program.
We've got a lot of dedicated Hazelden Betty Ford employees in Rancho Mirage, there where where our facility is at, and so I really believe there's a lot of people still working in their hearts. They really care, but it's harder. I think the patients are sicker. You know, over the last 10 to 15 years are coming in more poly-addicted. When I first got in the field, you see a 50-year-old male alcoholic come in.
That's
a
routine case.
It's pretty simple.
Let's get with this.
Yeah, now you're getting young people coming in already addicted to street heroin and no family life.
It's a terrible prognosis. Yeah. We have to take a little break. We'll be right back.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation in the This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest podcast or interaction with drdrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction per se. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the sites or podcasts.
Welcome back. This Life, Caleb Bacon is my special guest co-host. Bob Forrest is out giving birth, or at least his...
Well, his lady is giving birth.
Yes, his lady is giving birth. They're going to have a daughter any minute now. Hopefully, he'll check in with us. And just before we get started again with Bob Newton, I want to remind people about someone that has been very supportive of this program, an organization that makes Bergamet Mega Plus. And it's a nutritional supplement that I can get behind. It takes a lot for me to get behind this stuff. As a scientist, it's not easy to convince me. So I did a bit of research of my own, quite a bit, in fact. And I ended up taking this stuff. I've ended up recommending it for patients. It is an extract for the bergamot citrus fruit. It's a natural statin or HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor, and it has properties that lowers triglyceride, lowers LDL, raises HDL, just like a statin. And you can actually use it with a statin as well. It can address conditions like also the metabolic syndrome, which is, of course, increased abdominal fat, high cholesterol, triglyceride, high blood pressure, high blood sugar. Do you have
Why are you looking at me when
I have
you
it.
Say
I have it. I have it. Do you have it, Bob?
Hypoglycemia. No,
hold that mic up there.
Oh,
yes, I have the blood sugar issue.
Yeah. Do you have?
Yeah.
I've got blood pressure, cholesterol, the whole deal, and so and it's also had some really good results. The Bergamet Mega Plus with fatty liver, which is something that is the complication of all this stuff. So often we do prescribe statins, which are pharmaceutical, and do not do anything without talking to your doctor, of course. But this can be used with a statin. For a limited time, when you buy two bottles of Bergamet Mega Plus, you'll get one free. So to learn more, go to bergametna.com. That is bergametna.com. Or just go ahead and click the Bergamet banner on our website at drdrew.com. And again, privileged to say I can get behind this stuff. And I'm duly impressed. I have patients that can't tolerate statins and things, and this gives me another option for them. And some of them have fatty liver, so I will report to you on the progress of the fatty liver situation.
I may have some fatty liver going on.
Do you?
Yeah.
So. Do you still have... I mean, it's the alcohol plus the metabolic syndrome is sort of a double whammy for that.
Well, it's the managing to put on a beer gut in sobriety that's kind of been a bit of a problem.
You're not terribly overweight at all. You're just like, what, 5 pounds, lose 10 pounds?
I don't know.
But I
can lose 40.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That wouldn't be right.
I wouldn't be right, but I should do it, I feel like. No, I'm like 250.
You don't look it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
But 6'2", former Bob, I don't want to brag, but I was a lineman in junior varsity football.
You didn't play varsity football?
Junior varsity?
No, I retired.
Why?
Because I'm not a tough guy. I got into weightlifting
so
much that that just took over for me.
Did you steroids?
No. Are you offering?
No, I'm just wondering how you avoided it. You were an addict and weightlifting. That's a pretty typical combo, just road to the steroids.
Well, I progressed kind of slowly. And it wasn't until my 20s that I got really going with more drugs and really regular drinking. And I was pretty much not in the gym too much at that point.
Okay.
So steroids just didn't happen for me.
You just didn't have access.
Steroids
would have been a solution to a real good addict.
But I was not an addict who needed to see you.
Oh.
You
weren't severe.
I was not severe. Yeah. Now, I was severe enough to have died.
Yeah.
But I don't have trauma.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that sort of accelerant on everything.
Yeah.
So I knew the difference between right and wrong, and a lot of times I would cross a line. I wasn't happy about it, but just felt like I didn't really have a choice. And so I could, like, push certain things away for so long. And then steroids, I didn't really have to push away too much because I was out of the gym by the time I would have been open to it.
Yeah, Bob, what I always say is that, you know, if you have bad enough addiction, you need to see me. You had trauma. Because I see the, you know,
sure.
the sure. real deal stuff.
Yeah.
And four, if you need to see me, you need to be abstinent. Or on replacement. I understand that's another option for certain people.
Yeah.
But that's somebody, if you keep them on replacement, they're going to be chronically ill. You know, that's not going to ever be a flourishing life.
Yeah,
at least not likely. But they will survive. They'll survive it. It depends what our goals are in treatment. You know, or what are we trying to do?
Yeah,
I prefer to be in a field where, you know, the part of the field anyway, we want to restore people to full flourishing life. And I was going to give you some data on 12-step on this, because 12-step is under attack right now, right? Do you guys know this?
Is it?
Oh, not. It's been a little lighter lately, but if you go online on social media, you will get attacked by these sort of anti-AA.
Well, social media, if you say it's sunny out, people will attack you for that.
Yeah, I'm just saying that there's an anti-AA 12-step sort of wind blowing. And, you know, Doug, what's his name?
Doug Stanhope.
Doug Stanhope, you know, champions that and attacks me and has a whole, you know, army behind him.
He's a special case, though.
He is a special case, but is, you know, I don't dislike Bob Stanhope. Doug Stanhope, I like Doug Stanhope. And everyone has to live. I'm not into telling anybody how to do anything. I mean, if they want help, I've got some ideas. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, go ahead and live your life. Enjoy, man. And Doug has a certain life he lives, and God bless
him. He doesn't want abstinence.
No, he doesn't want anything. He wants to go on what he's doing. And God bless him. That's all good. But if he ever needs some help, now they have all this data now out on cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational enhancement therapy, combos of these things, 12-step. And in terms of abstinence, 12-step is still the best outcomes. Whether you combine it with things, whether you do it alone, there's two caveats, though, I would say. One is that if you demand a patient go to 12-step, they don't do very well. It has to come from within, at least a little bit, number one. And then number two, the thing about 12-step that I think a lot of people don't understand is it's free. So everyone that's worried about healthcare costs, please. There's a concern. It's not professionally managed. I understand that that's an issue. But the other thing is that, you know, early in recovery, somebody has to sit on you. Somebody who knows your disease deeply has to be around you all the time. And you can't pay a professional to do that. You can't. And by the way, that's a power imbalance, too. This is just somebody who cares enough to sit on you and understand your condition, which is a much more equitable relationship as opposed to somebody in authority sitting on you 24/7. Right. It's almost, imagine an addict with that. I mean, all he or she would think about is getting out of here. Mm-hmm. So people don't think about that piece. There's a sort of a 24/7 component to 12-step. And then there's the trust building and the relationship building, which takes immense amount of time. Immense. Yeah. And the professionals, it's just not practical. If everyone had their own personal team of therapists, I guess that would be a little better, probably. Maybe.
Or
maybe
not. Those very expensive sober coaches.
I'm not sure that's a weird relationship, too. Sometimes.
No, I'm not saying I like it, but that's literally a way to have somebody sit on you 24/7.
Well, it is, but I would argue that the way addiction works, you need to have multiple kinds of people around you, because you'll zero in on that one person and work them. But you have different people with different personality qualities that respond in different ways. It's good for you, and it's also good in terms of keeping the disease contained. You know, we would, you know, that's why you can talk about teams. I'm sure you work in great teams, and that's the one of the magic and fun parts of treating addicts. Yeah.
I think that's a great point, Drew, that you made about 12-step support. Is I've known patients, I've known people over the years that, you know, when they got out of treatment or when they first got sober, they went to two or three meetings a day, you know, just to keep them in a safe environment and to have the support. And that's how they made it, you know, with that kind of
somebody's couch
support. Yeah. And just going to the meetings and being present and having that. Now, I see some of that on social media too, to anti-AA messages and so forth, and I just kind of glance over them because I just go from personal experience and what I've observed for the last 33 years.
What's happening in the professional sphere, which is a little concerning, is they'll go, well, if abstinence your goal, they'll do it that way.
Yeah.
If you're going for abstinence, well, then there's a superior outcome here. But if you're just going for, they have measures like, you know, reduced drinks per week and, you know,
harm reduction. Right?
Well, you're just taking this pill and not that. You know, and that's not even the harm reduction piece yet.
Oh, okay.
That's just considered therapeutic success in terms of reducing the intensity of the disease.
Yeah.
And I would argue again, keeping somebody chronically ill is not. I mean, sort of, well, that's what I was talking about earlier, and meeting people where they are. There's a much greater sort of willingness to do that now. Yeah. And to some extent, okay, in a social model, you can kind of bring people along, maybe,
yeah,
right? But your really goals needs to be absent.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, at Hazelden, we have a Core 12 program that has, I think, drawn up a little controversy where we've extended their Suboxone use, you know, with the statistics, but with an end date.
The key is, though, you have to have physicians that do the end date.
Yes.
My peers are all like, oh, you're in withdrawal. We'll have to keep it going. Yeah. Of course they're in withdrawal.
Yeah.
When they come off this drug, they're going to be in withdrawal. That no matter how slow you go, there's going to be a little something. And you've got to just hold the line.
Yeah.
Just the way you would if they were in full-blown withdrawal.
Yeah. And our standard protocol there, I think, is 10 days of detox.
Well, that's just a detox pill.
Yeah.
It's not even a maintenance pill at all.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's not. I would not call that harm avoidance.
Right.
The harm avoidance is when they get to 16 milligrams and the doctor goes, "Oh, you seem very uncomfortable. Let's just leave it here. We'll deal with this later." And they never do.
And your point about, I'm concerned about a lot of the outpatient physicians that prescribe the opiate detoxes,
and it's
not wrapped with any clinical services.
I couldn't even if I had a team around me, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I couldn't handle it. It's not structured enough. For opiate addicts need shitloads of structure.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose maybe if they were in a sober living and they had a team and they had people, other people involved.
Yeah.
But now you're talking about extremely expensive treatment.
Yeah. But I think there's some people out there that just goes to their physician. They get the...
A lot of that.
Yeah, and they get their opiate...
And most of them use it as a way to keep chipping and keep the heroin going or whatever they're using.
Yeah.
But you seem like you have a very optimistic attitude about things. I've been a little bit. Bob and I get a little bit burned out and pessimistic.
Well, I've been in the chemical dependency field about 30 years, but I've had a lot of different positions because I haven't just been a counselor. I've counseled off and on, and I've been in administration and some other roles. And my preferred role is education, though, and speaking to people and young people. When I first got sober for years, I went into high school assemblies, and I'd have 200 kids there. And if I just helped one kid, I felt it was worth that.
What was the main part of your story they attached to, you think?
Well, the main thing was that I just described a very subtle progression that I never thought I would have a problem with alcohol and other drugs when I first started experimenting with those drugs. And advertisement, I think our young people are bombarded with advertisements to drink, and this is what men do, and beautiful women drink, and so I think there's a lot of mixed messages with young people. I try to talk about that issue a little bit.
Got some emails that our producer Susan Pinsky from Calling Out gave us. Here's one: I would love to hear you guys' thoughts on why we think the DEA has decided to keep pot as a Schedule I substance. They've actually lightened it up a little bit. What they've done is, it used to be just University of Mississippi was able to grow the pot for research. Now they've allowed other centers to be doing the research.
That doesn't sound like too much of a lightening up.
It isn't. I think the Schedule I is sort of silly.
So, for the listener, what else is on Schedule I?
Heroin and cocaine. And other, you know, not cocaine. Cocaine is actually Schedule II.
And isn't like meth Schedule II?
Yeah.
Also?
Yeah. And of course, the oral opiates and things, you know. And so,
according to the DEA,
yeah,
pot is worse than meth,
worse than opiates. I would much rather have a chronic pain patient on pot than big doses of OxyContin and taking their benzo along with that. And no one will die of pot. That's the thing that's troubling to me. It's the opiates are killing people hand over fist, and it's so hard to treat.
Are they starting to? I've heard that they're starting to keep doctors accountable with the prescription piece.
They absolutely are. And by accountable, it's just more, you know, cultural pressure that we've shifted from this notion that pain is what the patient says it is. And there was a time when if you didn't treat pain adequately, you would lose your job. You could go to jail in certain states.
Mm-hmm.
You would certainly be open for malpractice. You know, we had, it drove me absolutely out of my mind in every, hospital I've ever worked at, they've got the pain was the fifth vital sign. We're going to deal with pain. Idiots that decided. There was a bunch of attorneys that decided it, not for the clinicians. I mean, the clinicians jumped on board because they made giant industries out of it. Of course, the drug companies were like, yeah, go. But they weren't the problem. They just pulled the sail up on the ship. It was us sailing the ship, I'm telling you.
So let's see. I was going to tell you something about how it got out of hand, and now I can't remember my train of thought.
The pain.
The fifth vital sign. So you get these little pictures. I'm sure you've seen this as an administrator. The little happy faces going from very, very sad to very, very happy. It was like 10 of them. And, you know, my patients were all, on, you know, 10 being happy, 1 being miserable. My patients were all 1s. Mm-hmm. And so we would get called in by administration all the time going, Department of Mental Health won't allow this. You have to address their pain. I am addressing their pain. I'm treating their addiction. They will be an 8 in 4 days, I promise, unless I do something, in which case they may stay in a 1 to 4 for indefinitely.
Yeah.
And so we have to get the administrators on board to stand up to Department of Health, and we'd have to show that, you know, they'd be miserable for a week, and then they'd be 5, 6, even the chronic pain patients.
Dr. Pinsky, we're going to have to let you go. Your average patient is a -4.
Yeah, I know, and that's what you lose your right. And this, and as the department, all the different administrative organizations, the bureaucracies are on your ass. The attorneys are on your ass. It's terrible. You can't do your job. You must have seen that as administrator.
Well, I've seen this progression of pain medication just explode the last, 10, 12 years. I don't know. But
it's gone right up.
And the politics and whatever was all behind it, I mean, that's a simple explanation that you gave. I can see where the doctors are under pressure to comply. But getting back to marijuana, I never thought I lived long enough to see that marijuana was legalized in, and I'm sensitive to marijuana because I was addicted to it.
One of your drugs, yeah.
Yeah, so I...
So what do we do with that? How do we reconcile the fact that we have people that really get harmed by it, and even some occasional users get harmed by it, but the people who make the laws, and I mean the populace, would like it to be legal? How do we reconcile this?
For me personally, I'm going to see it just like alcohol. That if it's legal, that doesn't mean I have to use it, and I don't go into bars, and I won't be going into pot houses and stuff like. For me, that's the way I'm going to have to. But as a society, I think there'll be some social harm from it. I heard in Colorado there's been some. Because I don't think people will really use it for medicine. They'll for the medicine purposes.
If you walk down Venice Beach today, there's a guy with a sign on the billboard saying, "The doctor is in, come get your prescription."
And they'll try to pull you in. They're aggressive.
Yeah.
But that's California. In Colorado, it's like alcohol.
I don't know if this is true, but I heard that there's, you know... not real good people going into Colorado now trying to get part of that business. And so I think some social ills will come, just like when we started approving gambling casinos. You know, I it's great recreation, but I think some of the social ills that have come out of it have been pretty significant, you know, with gambling addiction and family financial strife.
Let me read you guys a couple more emails here. 36-year-old, addiction since 2004, started drinking at age 24, never heavily, OxyContin, 2004, just once a week, and this, lo and behold, more, 2008 methadone, 95 milligrams, down to 25, back up to 55, got pancreatitis in 2013, which to me means he was drinking. Been over a year since I stopped drinking, okay, but I'm back at it. I'm on disability, I suffer from extreme bipolar, my anxiety meds, which means the benzos, which I do not abuse. I've never felt high from them, but they do help my anxiety. And I'm looking forward to get clean, so he's taking benzos and opiates, which should never be prescribed together, and he's drinking. Pancreatitis can kill me. That's true. Never a needle user, no heroin, only painkillers. Well, to me, I don't see a giant difference. I'm
you
sorry.
Don't get points for that.
Yeah, not for me. I want to do this.
Because you can still die just as easily.
Now, here's the caveat. I really want to do this one step at a time and not throw my body for a total loop of withdrawal from, you know, this is too much, being a disability. I can't get into expensive rehabs. So, there's one of those cases. We see lots of, right?
I think it'd be a good case for you, Dr. Drew.
He is a typical case for me. That's right. But the conundrum always is no family, no resources, and the stuff you really need, and no motivation. He doesn't really understand what he's dealing with. If I were ruler of the world and I could help this guy, I would put him somewhere for a year, but it would, or 2 years, frankly.
Yeah.
And it would not have to be intensive. It's just steady. Just steady as she goes.
But you mean inpatient?
I mean like a sober living.
Oh, okay.
A sober living with a therapist, with a doctor,
but not round the clock, whatever. I mean, he might need it for a few days to get him off.
Some sort of structured environment.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, he might be able to do it just on a Suboxone detox. I mean, maybe yeah, this is the guy for that.
And he's not going to be able to escape the
withdrawal. Yeah,
of
it's just the way it goes. Yeah, and the withdrawal is the easiest part. It's what I ever tell everybody. You'll get through it. You won't even remember it. But the benzo withdrawal could be an issue for him. So he needs somebody skilled to deal with it. Yeah. Benzo alcohol, common thing. We use lots of barbiturates to get people off that. And
we had a doctor out there, Dr. Garrett O'Connor, was a addiction
psych. I love Garrett.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He always calls that withdrawal process as authentic suffering.
Yeah.
And it is.
Yeah.
And I ask patients, don't forget it, because if you don't want to repeat it, you know, use that as a reminder to keep you motivated.
Garrett gave a great lecture about spirituality. Yeah. Did you hear that lecture?
Yeah, yeah.
I've always wanted to reproduce it myself, but I can't. Only he can talk about it. But he did talk about, if I recall, how skeptical he was about it.
Yeah.
And about what miracles he had seen and how he understood it. And if I understood him right, I think he's in the same boat I'm in, where he really sees spirituality as more of a human-to-human connection and all the stuff that goes into that.
Yeah. He had about two or three talks that were just very, very profound and would just keep you at attention at all time.
If anybody has issues with spirituality or 12 step, please go listen to Garrett O'Connor. Yeah. Listen to John Kelly out of Brigham and Young Women's in Harvard. These people give talks that aren't just persuasive; they are. And you can find, I bet you can find them online. There must be YouTube video or something of these guys talking.
And these are scientific minds.
These are great clinicians, and they're. Transformative isn't a strong enough word. I don't have a word. Eye opening.
But these aren't the typical advocates for this stuff.
No, these are careful scientists who were, have come through years of experience and research, have some very strong arguments, and they're compelling. I guess is the best word. All right, I'll take another quick break. I'll be right back.
I want to welcome Aloe Treatment Centers out in Malibu as a new sponsor. I know we can trust it because I started it and I work there.
I can vouch for that.
But the fact is, it's the way we used to do things.
You and I?
Yes.
Yeah.
Basic Minnesota model, really strong boundaries with clients, individualized treatment plans.
Absence-based.
Yeah,
great team.
It's a great team, been there a long time. Some of the people have been there since the beginning. But here's the other thing, is millennials need to learn how to get their driver's license and get a job, and we're starting a coffee house where the kids are going to work.
Great.
That type of stuff. So it's like the best of the 20th century and a new 21st century model.
Which is social employment rehab.
Growing up.
Vocational rehab.
Personal responsibility.
Connecting in the world, being in the world, and recovery.
Yeah, long term.
Well done. We're back. It's This Life. Bob Forrest is experiencing This Life. He's in the labor delivery room.
Hey.
What's happening? How's it going?
By the end of this podcast, a child will be born.
how dilated are we?
10 or 11. Okay. Like 10. Okay. And the baby's head is down. We're waiting. They're doing a OR C-section, and then the team is coming down here.
And then has she started pushing yet?
No, not yet.
Okay. All right.
But it's going to happen fast. It's been 30 hours in the making.
I wish I could tell you that was true, but it may not be that fast. A nulliparous female can have a real tough time that first go around.
What did you call her?
Nulliparous. Yeah. As opposed to multiparous. Nulliparous. Never having delivered before, it means. First timer.
Oh, okay.
First timer. We got to, work it in, as it were. And there any decelerations or anything? The baby's in distress at all?
No, not at all. Everything's good.
So what's the baby's name?
Sydney Magic Forest.
Nice.
It'll be magic when it comes out.
I know. And it's because Chrissy loves Magic Johnson, and it's Magic Johnson's birthday today.
Ah.
Okay.
Little happenstance for you.
All right, my friend. Well, we're pulling for it. We want to hear all about it. We keep checking in with us as you go here, all right?
I'm going to. Okay.
Once the pushing starts, both Caleb and Susan would like to be in the room with you in some fashion.
They both were like, they're very excited that they'd be part of the pushing episodes. So so call in when you got that going on, all right?
We're good cheerleaders.
Okay. Make sure you're okay with Chris.
All right, talk soon. Bye.
It might be a little loud. But it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know what listener gets that experience.
His lady friend will feel about that. But anyway,
or woman.
But Bob, I really appreciate you. We have a few more minutes, but I want to just say thank you for being here and thank you for the work you do and you know for being a presence in the field.
Well, thank you.
We have so many great people in this field, and if anything else, people should attach to that and understand that. And if you get confused by all the headlines and the anti this and the pro that and the whatever, just get around good people because that's what's magic about recovery. Yeah. It is one human helping another. Yeah. Well, sometimes whole teams of people, but it's an interpersonal recovery, and that's where a lot of crazy magic happens.
Yeah. Well, I've appreciated your dedication to this field and the tremendous asset you've helped our society in building awareness.
I'm like I've gotten out of the trenches and I'm more in the educational piece now. Yeah. But I spent 20 plus years in the trenches, and
I watch you, and I really admire your patience and calmness with the real entitled patient. I mean,
it's all to me. You're laughing. I laugh too because I know that's all the BS of the disease. Yeah. They're so funny. They're so funny.
Yeah.
And I know. And if you didn't know what's on the other side for them, you couldn't be patient.
Yeah.
You have to have seen the miracles over and over and over again to have faith. And I'm sure you've experienced what I've experienced, which is the ones you know. Sometimes people surprise you by not getting it. You think they're going to get it. Sometimes you wouldn't give a prayer to suddenly get it. And so you're given a chance to everybody because all of a sudden someone gets going and it's miraculous. That's how I got first involved in the field. I saw some recoveries and I was like, what was that? Yeah. That girl was dying 3 months ago. I 6 months ago, 9 months ago. I saw her. She was going to die. And that's who that is now. That's not the usual thing in medicine where you go from sort of ill to chronically ill, you know what I mean, or ill to sort of whatever. But from dying to amazing, nothing else in medicine is like that. And now here it is, the problem of our time. Mm-hmm. A lot of nudniks getting involved in it. A lot of people getting involved that perhaps shouldn't be involved. But I guess we need armies to deal with it.
Well, I go back to when they, you know, back Well, they used to throw alcoholics and drug addicts in the psych wards up until, late 50s?
It's a great book somebody sent me. I think Ryan Halliday sent it to me, called Asylum.
Yeah.
And it's very much where Bob and I worked, how they used to treat alcoholics.
Yeah.
And just TLC for a year at most. Yeah. That's the best.
Oh, yeah. Drew, you need to talk about that.
That book?
No, how they used to treat patients at
Los Encinos was like a history of psychiatric care. Yeah. You know, it was there for 130 years old now. I was there in the 80s. I started there, and there were still psychiatrists there that have been there since the 30s and 40s, and they would tell stories about all the crazy stuff. And you know, whenever I hear Scientology taking on psychiatry, I go, yeah, they did do some pretty bad stuff sometimes. They were trying. They were desperately ill people, but in the name of trying to help desperately ill people, they did some crazy stuff. Like, they had insulin shock therapy. They'd made people so hypoglycemic they would seize. They had electric shock was invented there, but back in those when it was not invented there, but early phases of it were carried out there.
Pioneered,
and they would
Nurse Ratched style.
They would take the people. They'd lie on the floor. Four people would hold them down. They'd put tongs on either side of their head, and they'd push this box with a red button and slam it down, and they'd see. It's just crazy.
And that worked out really well, right?
Well, the electric shock therapy did tend to work a little bit, but I saw cingulotomies. I saw the downstream effect of. They cut out, you know, it's very much like a lobotomy. Cingulotomies are like a localized lobotomy. And, oh, my God. And these people were, as I looked through the prism of what I could tell of their history, largely addicts or borderline personality. Yeah. Those were the two that would get that. And they'd just crush their frontal lobe, and that's that. And off they'd go. And, man, was it a disaster later. Just severe, severe neurological impairments. What else, Susan? Do you like the story that the alcoholics just got TLC? I mean, W.C. Fields died there. He used to block his movies in the Rose Garden out in front of some of the bungalows there. Mae West would visit him. She was in Pasadena, and it was just a lot of sort of weird TLC, like, you know, just we'll detox you. And somebody asked me an interesting question on Twitter. They said, because I take issue always with this idea of cleanses and detoxes, and they go, well, what do you do? You detox people from drugs. I go, okay,
Good. Good question. Cleanses and detoxes, you know, when people drink juices and stuff, none of that has any meaning whatsoever. And I would urge you just to start with the idea of a toxin. Just whoever starts talking about toxins, have them to please just write the formula of said toxin down. Just write it down. And then once we have the formula, the chemical formula of that toxin, we can write the stoichiometry of how it damages. And then we can write the stoichiometry of the chemistry, just the basic chemistry of how it comes out through drinking a juice. How it's pulled out through what? The luminal surface of the small bowel? And none of it makes any sense.
You don't understand, Drew. It's Eastern medicine. You're schooled in Western medicine. You just don't get it.
Stop already.
You got to drink this cayenne pepper and the water.
But detoxing is just a colloquial term for a period of time of what the body goes through when they stop doing their chronic drug. And that's withdrawal. And when you treat withdrawal, you treat it typically with medications, and that's just called the detox. It's a colloquial term for what we're doing. It has nothing to do with toxins. It has nothing to do with actually detoxing. It's just making it safe to come off the drug, because your body will react so profoundly to what it has become accustomed to that you can die. And it's just to prevent you from dying. And trust me, whatever toxin you're pulling out with the cayenne pepper or whatever, not going to hurt you. Because, well, let's just write it down. Just figure out which formula. Come on, Caleb.
Is there a colloquial way that they're using detox to mean something different?
Who?
The hippies.
The
juice people.
No, because they start talking about removing toxins. And now you're in a zone
where you have
to show me the structure of said toxin. Just write the chemical formula out. Just the formula. Just the chemical formula.
No, look, I'll defer to the fact that you went to med school. But there's a...
Are you going to you a toxin guy?
No, not at all. No, I think it's hilarious. Yeah. But I'm just kind of giving you the counterpoint.
Okay, go ahead.
But is there, like, let's say you go to a nutritional store and they're like, oh, you got to take these. It cleanses your liver.
Yeah. What is that? That's a meaningless cleanses of what? And give me the physio. Forgetting the. I can't even spell stoichiometry. I'll even not have you tell me the chemistry. Just tell me the physiology of what that even means. What are you talking about? Now, that Bergamet Mega Plus, I'm talking about reversing fatty liver.
Mm-hmm.
That is a function of the oxidation reduction state of the cells. That's a complex.
That sounds like science.
Chemistry, yeah. And it has very much to do with the overall metabolism of your body in terms of insulin resistance, the triglyceride levels, the cholesterol metabolism, and there are ways to reduce the oxidative stress on those cells. Now, I'm willing to have that conversation with somebody, but I promise you that's not what they're doing.
Nice plug.
Anyway, I want to go back to Bob's stuff. I got another question here. We got lots of emails here today, so I want to get into some of these. This is a half-brother battling addiction, classic signs of bipolar since age 11. I don't know there are classic signs of bipolar at age 11, but okay, now 26, thinking of killing himself. He has 50 tablets of Tylenol, which will do it if he doesn't get the... There is a... What's the word they use? Antidote to Tylenol overdose, which you have to get it within the first few hours. Mm-hmm. He separated his wife, told his family and friends that he wants to kill himself. He's keeping up a line of communication with a few. They've had law enforcement out there looking for him. Oh, boy. They found him at a rest stop. Based on the suicidal text, law enforcement admitted him for 24 hours, but they released him, which is, I don't know about you, but I see so many people just shouldn't have been let out that's the insurance companies dictating. I'm telling you. Yeah, doctors would never do that on their own. He's a manipulator. His pattern, when he gets manic depressive, he starts, he relapses on tobacco, then alcohol, and then street drugs. He does not want to get help. We've been through a lot. Let's see. For about 5 years, he was sober in a Christian-based 12-step program. Huh. That was like a 9-month inpatient program. That sounds good, right? I mean, I don't know what they were doing, but it's got all the requisites there. Went through it twice. So what is the question? He said goodbye. He's already taken the pills. Oh, boy. Listen, I always am a believer in getting people back to where it's worked for them before. So if that program has worked for him, get him back. Very simple. They know him. They'll embrace him. Even if it's just to get him back to his home meetings, get him. And then the other thing I would say is these threats and things, you're doing the right thing with law enforcement. Do not cut corners on that. If he threats, picked up, period. Yep. Get him. now and scream like hell at the hospitals that let them out, and feel free to threaten the insurance company, because that's where the rubber hits the road. Did you see this thing the other day where Hillary Clinton got, you know, coverage for a guy and got him, it was some sort of bladder cancer or something, and she got him coverage. I thought, it's that easy? Just have a politician call the insurance company? Mm-hmm. That's how screwed up these guys are? That if somebody in power actually threatens you, do you do the right thing? But otherwise, you're just sitting under the radar?
I agree with you about having, you know, I think every emergency room should have a alcohol drug counselor specialist that can do an assessment, because a lot of those people in the emergency rooms are there from alcohol. They're drug-related.
There's something happening in ERs you may not be aware of. You're not aware of, I don't think, Caleb. Maybe you heard on this show, but the ER doctor's job now is contingent on the patient satisfaction surveys. How do you think that goes with our patients?
So the more drugs they get, the higher the rating.
If they don't get the drugs, though, which is what the doctor's trying to do, they should have an exemption for addicts and alcoholics, which is that, that's going to be an unhappy person because we're not going to gratify what they're in there looking for. But no, that doctor will lose his or her job if they don't maintain the patient satisfaction.
Yeah.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
I mean, therein is some, again, people want to blame the drug companies for this.
Yeah,
that's nothing to a drug company.
No,
that's hospitals and lawyers again and insurance companies. Yes, that's where the evil lies. Too strong a word. That's where the problem lies.
Yeah, and I think some illnesses need to be treated differently. I believe chemical dependency. I think long term treatment. The research is pretty clear that relapse rates go down.
Yes.
And in the long run, you may spend more on the front end, but you're going to save.
We developed a lot of expertise in honing down the cost, and we could treat somebody for like $1,500 a month, in varying levels, with outpatient and sober living and the whatever. That all of a sudden got very popular with the insurance companies, and magically the price went up.
Yeah,
I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah,
that was a little concerning to me.
But that structure, that's good structure.
Yes, it's adequate.
24/7.
It's fine. It's excellent, and you can really deliver that economically.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you thinking, Caleb? I see your mind going.
Well, you guys are the professionals.
What are you thinking? Come on.
No, I'm just taking it all in here. But the medical field, the way the business works, I can't understand it. Part of it doesn't make sense, and then where it came from, I don't really know the history. But I'm just wondering if part of it with the ER is that they want to get people out of there as soon as possible. So if they seem happier, then that's a way to do that.
Well, like Drew was saying, the insurance too. I mean, the surgeries I have, they want me out of there as soon as I can go to the bathroom.
Yes, but that's actually a good thing because the infection rates and things like that start to go up if you stay in, and blood clots and things. But that when that first started happening, I was practicing medicine, and it was difficult because we didn't really have the infrastructure to get people out, and to follow them and to watch them, and we didn't know really what would happen outside of our supervision and nursing.
Yeah.
And we have a track record now with that. That's a good thing. But it all started with the fact that hospital care got very expensive, so that people had to have funds put aside for catastrophes. That it's called insurance against catastrophe, and then it became an entitlement. Then it became just everyone's supposed to have everything and not pay anything all the time for anything, for whatever they want. And I'm not sure that's a viable system. Now, in this case, both the insurance companies and the hospitals want to be able to market the fact that we have the highest patient satisfaction service. It's not about getting in and out. It's about we have satisfied customers.
Yeah.
They're starting to run like resorts or hotels, which to some extent they could learn a little bit from. I mean, it's not a totally bogus idea to how about the food? Let's bring that up to good standards.
On one hand, there's all the surgical centers popping up in L.A.
to get out of hospitals, get away from hospitals.
That I've noticed that are fancy.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't get a hospital. Well, you level of care is same, but you get a nicer experience.
And the insurance companies like it because it doesn't have all the cost of a hospital.
You don't stay overnight.
You may. Well, some of those have literally associations with hotels now, and they put a nurse in there, and that's all they need. All right. This reminder of Buddy. that this whole This Life podcast is courtesy of DonDrew.com, and you can support the show by clicking on the Amazon banner. For all your shopping needs, you pay nothing extra, but it puts a little wind in the sails here of This Life. Also, we love hearing from you, so go to DonDrew.com/contact and send us your questions. And for Facebook fans, we now have, finally, the DonDrew Facebook page. I'm going to try to do some of the videos there now. Caleb Nation, who's helping us with that. Caleb's a great guy if you want to follow. Do you follow Caleb Nation?
No, but I feel like I support every Caleb. Like we're just a small
I think you're with a C, though. He's with a K.
Oh, then I don't support
you
him.
You get my emails to him all the time.
That has happened. There's been some cross-Caleb-ing.
But we can't. But Facebook is where we're trying to get a little more active, and I'll put some videos up there, hopefully. When we were traveling, I got a little interactive there and time to do that. We're sorry we can't read everyone's question, but we will be reading some of them here and taking some calls, but we can't respond to everyone's question. And you can always tweet us your suggestions at This Life Podcast, or go to at First Lady of Love for future guests, future suggestions, future ideas. And Bob, it's been a real privilege to share a little time with you.
Thank you, Drew.
And thank you for all the work. It's we need to create an army. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I feel reassured by your quiet confidence right now, because I felt like we're tacking against the wind a bit, and you're out there, you see it.
Well, I'm an offensive lineman, so I got to clear the way for.
Well, I appreciate that. You're going to be my. What position were you? Was guard?
I was offensive guard.
So yeah. I want you to pull and get in front of me, and let's do this. Now, by the way, did you see that tight end for the Rams last night? He's good.
Yeah.
What was his name? Shear or something?
I don't know. He's a big guy.
We talked about that earlier.
Tall guy,
but he was good.
Bob, for the thoughts and worldview you have on recovery, if people want to learn more, are there materials or websites you can send people to?
I would encourage them to go to the HazelandBettyFord.org website. We have a lot of educational materials and videos and so forth. And if they have any questions, they can talk to a professional there about family members or themselves.
And let me say, Betty Ford has been a quality operation for a leader in a quality operation for decades. It became... I'm not sure people understood the quality that Betty Ford gave, because it became a place where a lot of celebrities went and then sort of didn't follow through. A lot of them were not ready for sobriety.
Yeah.
So it became sort of a place that was perceived by some, not myself, as sort of being gratifying to some of these people. And you don't want to gratify.
Right.
But they've all... And now with the Hazelton Association, and listen, you will get excellent care at Betty Ford. This is, I'm under no obligation to say this, but I've referred to Betty Ford for years and years and years. Yeah. And also Harry Harutunian.
Oh, yes.
I love Harry.
Dr. Harry's is our top-notch physician there.
And I did a podcast, if you want to go to DonDrew.com, the DonDrew podcast. I did an hour with him a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But I when you find like-minded people. And Harry's one of those guys.
So. Yeah. And that show's probably behind the paywall. So you have to join the premium paywall podcast at podcast1.com.
Yeah, so that's not us. That's not This Life. That's the Dr. Drew podcast over at Podcast One and the Corolla Empire, all that stuff. But that was something I did years ago. So, well, Bob, thank you so much. Do you have something to follow? You can follow a Twitter handle or anything else if we want to follow you.
I don't have a
Facebook page.
I have a Facebook page.
Do you want our people clamoring in there?
I put up a lot of football stuff in there if they want to reminisce. But it's under Bob Newton and Seattle Seahawks or Chicago Bears.
Great. All right. So. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next time.
In the valley, when there's peace in my heart, the road is so winding that you just get lost. My friends, let me tell you, as dumb as it sounds, well, kindness is everything, and love is all there is. Truth, chaos, and beauty. Truth, chaos, and beauty. Oh, religion and philosophy can teach you to hate. But the sun coming up again, another baby gets born, and there's no rhyme or reason. Finish then start, and kindness is everything, and love is all there is. Truth, chaos and beauty. There will be peace in the valley when there's peace in my heart, and the road is so winding that you just get lost. My friends, let me tell you, as dumb as it sounds, kindness is everything, and love is all there is. Well, kindness is everything, and love is all there is.